Can you tell me your full name?
My full name is Lynn Elda Kilgore, M.D.
Thank you. And where were you born?
I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina.
And when was that?
I have to tell you when I was born.
You don't have to tell me anything. You can
ballpark. A long time ago.
A long time ago? Okay. And how long did you live in North Carolina?
1 year.
Okay.
Yes, my parents moved to New York when I was one.
Wow.
So they were part of the Great Migration from the South to the North. I don't know anything about North Carolina.
Okay.
Okay.
So you're not back here.
I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah. Did you move straight to Harlem?
No, actually, this house I'm living in now. No, that's not true. The first Harlem house was that was Washington Heights. My father was a minister. He pastored a church on 131st Street between 7th and Lenox, Friendship Baptist Church. However, when we first moved here, we lived in the Bronx on Prospect Avenue until I was about 6 or 7. And then the church bought a parsonage in Queens, so we lived in Queens.
And the church was still located on 31st?
Yes, the church is still in Harlem.
And then how did you get from the Bronx to Harlem and from Queens to Harlem?
My father had a car, so when we came to church, or, you know, on Sundays especially, but also sometimes during the week for meetings or classes or something, my father would drive us. I always joke with people that I remember when the toll on the Triborough Bridge was 25 cents when I was a little girl. And because my father used to let my sister and I always give the toll person the quarter. And then as I got older, as my sister and I, there's two of us, but I'm the older of the two. When we got older, and when I say older, I'm talking like 10, 11, we rode the train and the bus from Queens to Harlem.
Did you ride by yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, nobody would send children that young on that long a trip nowadays, I don't think. But we lived in a two-fare zone, so we had to ride the bus to the subway.
Okay.
And my sister and I would do that. We would have to come in for choir rehearsal on Friday afternoons, the Saturday programs my father usually took us to. But Friday afternoons, he would already be at church. So we had to come, and then he would bring us home. But we made a lot of friends. My very best friend in life lived across the street from the church. I met her at the church, and we became very good friends. She's passed away now. But we got to know, I mean, we were in Harlem a lot, you know, especially on Sundays, of course. We were here all day on Sundays. And my father would take us out to restaurants sometimes. There was a white tablecloth restaurant called Frank's. It was a steakhouse. It's not here anymore. But it was probably the fanciest restaurant in Harlem. So every now and then, Daddy would take us there. Or, more usually, we would go to one of the church members' house for dinner. Baptist members always want to feed their pastor. Mm-hmm. So we ate a lot of good food at a lot of people's houses in Harlem. Yeah.
What kinds of things did you do as a child in the church while your father was working?
We sang in the choir, so we had choir rehearsal. Sometimes we helped out in the office, like if there was mailings to go out, you know, we would stuff envelopes, things like that. Or usually what we did while we were waiting, if we had to wait for him to go home, we usually like went to one of our friends' houses. And then, you know, he would, we knew what time to be back, so that we could go home.
And you said most of the friends, like, lived near the church?
Yes. Yeah. My best friend lived across the street.
Okay, yes.
From the church. My sister had a friend who lived, like, around the corner, a couple blocks. So, you know, she would go visit her friend, I would go visit mine.
What was that area like around the church and that block specifically?
Okay, the block, it's funny you should ask that. Right next door to the church, what was the church address? Okay, none of them. Anyway, right next door to the church was an apartment building that was taller than the church. And I don't think it's still there. I think they tore that building down. Anyway, there was a lot going on in that building. And periodically, people would throw bottles or trash down on the church roof. It was a really kind of rough clientele in that building. So much so that a lot of times my father worked in the evenings. He would stay late to do whatever he had to do. And there were a group of men that knew that he was there. And they would actually sit in front of the church and wait for him to come out, you know, to just make sure that nothing happened to him, you know. So it was kind of a rough neighborhood, yeah.
And were these men who also lived in that building?
Yes, they did. They lived in the building. And my father, much to my mother's dismay, would sometimes, if one of them got evicted or something, he'd bring them home. And, you know, to stay with us for a couple of days. And my mother was always like, you have daughters, you know, you can't do that. You can't be bringing these strange men in the house, you know. But he was like, it's okay, they'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And nothing ever happened. You know, they were just grateful to have some place to stay. But that was my father. He was, you know, he would help anybody.
What was your father's name?
Thomas Kilgore Jr.
What was your mother's name?
Janetta Miriam Scott Kilgore.
Were they both from North Carolina before?
My mother actually was from Virginia originally. But she went to Minor Teachers College, which was I'm not sure if it still exists, but it's the education department at Howard University. And she went to school there. She grew up in Virginia, and then her family moved to Washington when she was about 13. So she went to high school and college in Washington. So she was like a city girl. My father was from the sticks, first in South Carolina, and then the family moved to North Carolina when he was about 10. So our family roots on his side, he had 11 brothers and sisters, and there was 12 of them, so they all migrated from South Carolina to North Carolina. So we actually consider North Carolina, you know, our family home.
Okay. Or did anyone else from the family come to New York?
No. He was the only one that came to New York. Some of them went other places. Like most of them stayed in the South, and actually in the same town, Brevard, North Carolina, which is about 40 miles from Asheville. It's in the western part of the state in the mountains. He had a sister who, and actually they were the only two that went to college. My father went to Morehouse, my Aunt Melissa went to Spelman. And they're the only two that really branched out from the South. Aunt Melissa first moved to Detroit and then to Los Angeles, where she lived for like 60 years. And my father came to New York, and he also went to Los Angeles. in 1967.
So when did you move to Harlem?
When I moved to Harlem, we bought this house in 1986. So that is when I moved to Harlem. I lived in Washington Heights, up on 158th Street for a while. But that's in Harlem, so.
When, when did you live in Washington Heights?
When?
Yeah.
In the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah.
This is after your father had gone to Los Angeles.
Yes. Yes. When I graduated from college, I came right back. I didn't go to Los Angeles because I did not like Los Angeles. I used to go there on holidays when I was in school, and I was like, this is not the place for me. So when I graduated, I came back to New York. Yeah.
And so it sounds like Uptown felt really important to you.
Yes. Very much so. I was asked, the whole gentrification thing is kind of a mixed bag to me. On the positive side, it has brought better services to Harlem, because the businesses want to please the new folks. They didn't want to please us, but they want to please the new folks. And so, as a result, we get better services too. On the negative side, I was asked once by a gentrifier what I thought about gentrification. And my biggest complaint about it is that the people who are moving here, they don't want to become a part of the existing community. They want to change the community to make it theirs. And, this is something that we've had for a very long, long time. And I don't mind you coming, come on. But, join my community. Don't try to make my community yours. And so that's my biggest complaint about gentrification.
What are the things about kind of the existing community, especially that was here when you were a child, that like made you want to come back?
Well, definitely the population, the community population. It's nice to be among your own people. The food, the music, the churches. It's all stuff that's familiar to me from my childhood. It's home. So those are some of the things that would make me want to come back.
Yeah, and you're talking about like your people and like the importance of that cultural context. And you're talking about your family coming from the South. Mm-hmm. Were there other people around you that was also part of their kind of family's migration?
Oh, absolutely. Almost everybody. especially in the churches, in the church families. Everybody came from the South. Everybody had Southern roots. There were a few that had Caribbean roots. But most of the Caribbean, people with Caribbean roots, they were in Harlem at one time. But I know Valerie was just giving me this history the other day. She's amazing. I forget what year it was, but there was some year where they all moved to Brooklyn. Mm. Not all, but you know what I mean. They started a wave, and eventually Brooklyn became the epicenter for the Caribbean population. But they did start out in Harlem. But now, most of the black people in Harlem have Southern roots. North Carolina, there was a book, The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. Are you familiar with it?
I am, yeah.
And she describes the migration that, you know, that it really happened along the three train lines. That the Eastern train line, the people came to New York and Philadelphia. From the Carolinas, Virginia. The Midwestern train line, they went from Georgia, Alabama, you know, to Chicago. And the Western train line, Louisiana, Mississippi, they went to LA because it was just the, you know, because of the convenience of the transportation. So most of the people in Harlem are from North and South Carolina.
Was there, I asked this because my grandmother organized like a South Carolina group at her church.
Oh, okay.
So,
in Harlem?
No, she was in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
She went from Philadelphia to New Jersey.
Okay.
But that same train line.
Yep.
Were there kind of ways that you were talking about kind of news from North Carolina or like kind of connections to North Carolina kind of amongst people here?
No, not really. The news coming out of the South was usually family oriented. Everybody. So there was no kind of civic engagement with the past. It was only that your family was still there, and so any kind of news about your family, you know, which you did share sometimes with other people, but no, it wasn't like a news from North Carolina type of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And You had mentioned before, I could hear, it was your father, your mother, and your sister, and you.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people in your home?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about your mother?
Ah, my mother. My mother was a teacher. She actually taught in the same elementary school that my sister and I went to. So that was a challenge.
Which elementary school was that?
Public school. 127 Queens.
Okay.
Okay. she taught the sixth grade. And at that time they had, you know, hierarchies in the grades. There were 6-1, 6-2, 6-3. You're probably too young to remember
that.
Okay. But 6-1 was the smartest class, or any one, 5-1, 4-1, 6-1. The one class was the smartest class. And so she taught 6-1 at PS 127. My mother was a stickler for good English. She thought that the one thing that would elevate Black people and make them more acceptable is if they were able to speak the King's English. So she was brutal about correcting people. I mean, she didn't care who you were. You know, that's not correct. she was pretty bad with that. But my sister and I, you know, we know English. We're really good with English. My sister is a book editor.
Okay.
So that was one thing about her. She was very, she could be very critical, you know, of people. You know, she suffered no fools, okay? She was really, a lot of people, you know, sometimes really got their feelings hurt, you know, but she didn't mean any harm. She was just like, I don't play nonsense. And so, on the other hand, people had a tremendous amount of respect for her. Because if she became your friend or even listened to what you had to say, it was kind of like an honor, you know. She was an impeccable dresser. My mother wore high heels in the house.
Okay.
Her house shoes were high heels. She was great. I mean, you know, she was a hard taskmaster. But you know, I know she loved us dearly. My sister got along with her better than I did, because I was always kind of rebellious. My sister was pretty obedient. So my mother and I clashed a lot. But I never doubted that she loved me. You know, I always felt secure in that way. And she was an excellent, excellent first lady. Which she refused to be called, by the way.
Was there another way that she wanted to be described?
Just or? Mrs. Kilgore. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
She refused to let them call her first lady. So she was humble like that. And she was a very hard worker in the church. She worked on many different ministries. I think her favorite was missionary ministry. She and her sister had that in common. Her sister lived in Washington. And she also was like the president of her ministry, missionary ministry in her church. She also helped with the church credit union.
Mm-hmm.
She belonged to the Minister's Wives Convention of Greater New York. And she went to all those meetings. She started but didn't finish a master's program in education at Columbia. She was going at night after going to work, and it just got to be too much, so she dropped out. She had two good friends, teacher friends, that she used to hang out with occasionally. So yeah, that was my mom.
What time was she traveling for the missionary?
No, the only traveling that we did, there was a convention, I think it still exists, the Lot Carey Foreign Missions Convention, and it was a Baptist convention that had affiliates in India and Africa. And the people from India and Africa used to come to the States a lot, but I'm not, the only person that I know who went to India and Africa was the executive director of that convention. His name was Wendell Somerville. He used to travel around the world. But my mother was just like raising money, you know, just sending food and clothes and things like that. She never did any traveling.
What kinds of things did they do to raise money?
I don't remember them doing any events, although they may have. It's so long ago. I know that there was an offering that we had that was dedicated to missions. And I think primarily she just administered that money. I don't recall them having any big fundraising events. Yeah.
And then you mentioned the credit union as well. Was that restricted to church specifically?
Yes.
And was that something that had pre-existed, your family's involvement in the church, or?
No. That was something that that my father started. Yeah.
You talked a little bit about your father, like, and like that he was a minister, and that he was really involved in community work and caring for people, but what other kinds of initiatives is he involved in through the church?
Oh my God. My father is like an icon in Black Baptist history. He is the first Black president of the American Baptist Convention, USA. He became president in the 70s, I think. He also served as president of the Progressive Baptist Convention, which grew out of the National Baptist Convention, because in the 60s, the National Baptist Convention refused to let Martin Luther King speak at the convention. So a couple of the pastors who were members, my father among them, Gardner Taylor from Brooklyn, another one, pulled out of the National Baptist Convention and started the Progressive Baptist Convention, which exists to this day. And my father was one of the first presidents of that. He also was very close to the Martin Luther King family. He went to Morehouse in the 1930s, graduated in 1937, no, 35, they got married, 37. And at the time, Martin Luther King Jr. was a little boy, and my father had made friends. I think he went to the church and made friends with Daddy King. So he became Martin Luther King Jr.'s babysitter, you know, when he had time. and then the relationship just, you know, as Martin Luther King grew up, and when he became a civil rights leader, his network was pastors. The SCLC was really like a bunch of churches. And so my father became one of his closest advisors. You also know the story about the building on 130th Street, right? Do you know that story?
Tell me, yeah.
Okay. So the building, 170 West 130th Street, is a building that was owned by Friendship Baptist Church, my father's church. And we used it as kind of a community center. When it came time for the 1963 March on Washington, they were looking for a headquarters to plan, you know, the planning offices. And at first they were gonna go and they were gonna put it in the South, but then they were afraid that the Klan or others, you know, would burn it down or whatever. So A. Philip Randolph, who was the major organizer of the march, decided to have the headquarters in New York. And so he asked Daddy if he knew of any space. And my father said, I have space. So he turned over the community center to A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin for the 3 months that it took to plan the March on Washington. I actually worked for the march. I had a job at Chock Full of Nuts downtown that I had to be at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I got off work at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I would come uptown and go to the march headquarters. I remember being absolutely awestruck by Bayard Rustin. He was like a force of nature. Absolutely amazing man.
What about him really struck you?
The first thing that really struck me about him was his speaking voice. Have you ever heard him speak?
No.
Oh my God. It's like, is this a black man with this voice?
Okay.
He sounded English. His diction was so precise. He sounded very much English, and I had never heard anybody black sound like that. So I was just mesmerized by his speaking voice. And then the other thing that struck me about him was he was a chain smoker. He just one cigarette after the other. Okay. Okay. And also, he was always on the telephone. Just organizing things. He was unbelievable. You know, it was like he was everywhere all at once in that building. You know, just up and down the stairs, talking to the staff. And he, you know, for my poor little 15-year-old self, he was like, wow. You know? Right. And then the march came off. We went to the march. My church, I think we took 3 busloads of people to the march. It was just awesome. There's a photo of Martin Luther King at the march, standing at the podium, that you see quite often, and my father's in that picture.
Okay.
Yeah.
To show us that photo.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in that picture.
So you're like 15, you're working in this office for 3 months. What kinds of tasks were you doing?
What was her name? Rachel. Rachel was the office manager. And she had us, you know, we did envelopes, we went out and put flyers on cars and on stoops. Sometimes she would let us answer the phone. We went out and got food for everybody. You know, we were just like the gophers, okay? You know, anything that she wanted us to do, we did.
And when you say we, is it you and your sister? Is there
no, actually my sister, no, there was a couple other volunteers from my church. A guy named James Hamilton. James is the only one I remember actually being there all the time. My sister was working that summer in the New York SCLC office on 125th Street. And they, of course, were doing a lot of march organizing as well. Not so much organizing the march, but organizing people getting there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she worked on 125th Street.
What were kind of like family dinners or kind of coming together? What was it like at that time?
It was really, honestly, I don't know. I don't remember any particular, we did talk about stuff that we had done. My father would ask us what we had done that day. And we did talk about, you know, but it was also mundane what we were doing, you know? You know, it wasn't the exciting organizing, you know, that the adults were doing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Who were some adults that were really kind of influential to you or important to you at that time?
Well, of course, there was Martin Luther King, who actually was at our house a few times.
Was he staying at your house?
Yeah. One time he was there with his daughter, Yolanda. She was a little girl. She's younger than me. And she was a little girl. I was about, I don't know, 11, 12. And she was maybe 5 or 6. And our dog had just had puppies. And she wanted a puppy.
Of course.
So we gave her one, okay? And I don't know how they got that dog back to Atlanta. I think they were probably driving, because everybody drove everywhere in those days. So she got one of our dog's puppies while she and her dad were staying there.
That's funny.
There was Martin Luther King, and like I said, Bayard Rustin really had a tremendous effect on me. And then, you know, at the time, I was not sophisticated enough to even think about the fact that he was gay. But later on in life, I even gained more respect for him because all of the big six leaders at that time of the civil rights organizations, none of them wanted him to be the executive director of the march because he was gay. And A. Philip Randolph said, I don't care, he's my guy. And then he turned out such a magnificent job. You know, I mean, just everything was just perfect. Nothing went wrong that day, nothing. And so, you know, later in life, you know, learning that he was gay and that, you know, the kind of struggle that he had to go through. And I'm sure my father knew he was gay. And he gave him total support as well. So I gained more respect for him learning that he, have you seen that movie? The Coleman Domingo?
No.
It's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was, yeah. So, I'm trying to think, who else? There were other ministers that were friends of my dad that I really liked and admired. One of them, his name was George Lawrence. He was a minister at a church in Brooklyn. But he and my father were really good friends. I can't remember, what was that man's name? Oh, God. There was another minister who was out of Westchester County that was also a friend of my dad's that I really liked. His name I'm not going to remember right now. But I would say that the men in my family, in my life, that I had probably the most influence on me were the men in my family, my uncles.
Yeah.
My father had 8 brothers and just 3 sisters. And my Uncle Frank, who was one of my father's he was really close. They were close. My larger than life Uncle Rock, whose name was Rockefeller.
Okay.
And they say people try to live up to their names, and he definitely did. He was always, I mean, money was like so important to him. They all lived in North Carolina.
And did they come up often, or did you
go? No, we went to North Carolina once a year. My grandmother's birthday is July 28th, or was July 28th. I only knew one grandparent, it was my father's mother, because his father and my mother's parents all died before I was born. So my grandmother's young grandparent I never knew. And her birthday was July 28th, and all of her children came to North Carolina, to Brevard, for her birthday. And our family reunions that we have every 2 years are all centered around the last weekend in July.
Okay.
You know, because it's, you know, for her birthday. And that's how I got to meet all my cousins, because we started doing that when my sister and I, we were little, like 4 or 5 years old. And we went every single summer.
Mm-hmm. How long would you stay?
4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
To such an extent that we got to know our cousins. I mean, our first cousins were like sisters and brothers to us, and still are.
Yeah.
You know, I just saw one of my first cousins this past weekend. Her son got married. And we went down to Maryland for the wedding. We're both in our 70s and we're still like, you know, seeing each other again, you know, it's just like we never parted.
Get back up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's a nice thing about family. Yeah.
I'm curious how, like, your family, and especially your parents, but how they influence kind of the work you do now, or the work that, you know, how you've approached kind of organizing, institution making?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. My father, especially, has influenced the work that I do. My father was always an advocate for civil rights, and he was a lover of Harlem, and so I think he would be very proud looking down on me, seeing the work that I do to save Harlem now. Also from my father was an extremely organized person. And I think I have those skills learned from him as well, which have served me well, you know, at home, at work. You know, now the work that I do with Save Harlem now. It's funny, when I retired 10 years ago this year, Valerie is somebody, okay, Valerie I've known since the 1970s.
Okay.
She and my sister went to Berklee School of Journalism together. And I think Valerie was a little ahead of Jimmy, but they were there together. And I met Valerie when I went out to Oakland, where my sister was living in the 70s, to visit her. And Valerie was her friend. So I met Valerie. And then in the 80s, when I started going to church again, because I had stopped, you know, because I stopped going to church for a long time. I was like, I'm a preacher's kid. I was in church 24/7. I'm not going anymore. Okay.
When did you stop going?
I stopped going in the mid-70s, I want to say. And I didn't start going back until the mid-80s.
So this is in your, like, young adult life?
Yes. Yeah. And when I went back to church, I went to Cayman Baptist Church, which was on 116th Street. At the time, the pastor was Y.T. Walker, who was former chief of staff to Martin Luther King. And Valerie was a member of Canaan, and I ran into her again. And so, you know, I was at Canaan for a long, until Y.T. Walker died and retired. Well, first he retired, then he died. I did not like the new pastor, so I left in 2012. But I was there from the 80s to 2012. And I did a lot of things there. I was head of the publications ministry. Everything the church printed, put out in print, it came through my committee. Anyway, when I left Canaan, I lost touch with Valerie again. And then in 2019, I ran into her again. And I told her that I had retired and that I was really, like, looking for something to do. And I was just bored. You can sit home and watch TV all day. Okay.
Yeah.
not when you come from a background like mine, you know, where it's all about service. That's the other one. That's the word. Okay. My father has an autobiography that he and my sister wrote together. It's called A Servant's Journey. And my father was all about service and taught us, both of us, that that was really important, to serve others doing something. So Valerie said to me, I have something you can do. Right?
<Yeah.
laughs> And the rest is history. I'm like, oh my God. Okay. I know. I spend at least, during the gala, my husband was like, okay, enough. Because I was like doing 10-hour days every day when we were playing in the gala. That's over now. Mm-hmm. That was in May. But I would say on average, I spend at least 10, 15 hours a week doing Save All Now work. Sometimes more. Very rarely less. Okay. But, you know, I mean, it gives me something to do. But more important than that, it's something that I really believe in. I really believe that, you know, the history, the architecture, the culture of Harlem has to be preserved. It's too rich to let it go away.
How would you define preservation in that context?
How would I define preservation?
How do you want it to be preserved? You know, like,
well, I think preserving the built architecture is really important. You know, we have the same type of buildings that they have in the Village and on the Upper West Side. You know, it's just, I mean, some of the same architects built here just like they built there. And so why is it so important to save the Village where 66% of the housing stock is preserved? Upper West Side, 50%. And Harlem is like between 20 and 30%. I do understand why, but you know, we have to remedy that. And the Landmarks Preservation Commission is a very frustrating organization to deal with.
In what ways?
Well, in terms of Harlem, because other neighborhoods have gotten tremendous swaths preserved or designated all at one time. For some reason in Harlem, they want to do us in these little tiny pieces, and you know, one at a time. So that it's going to take forever. We have on our website, I think it's 34 individual buildings that we think should be landmarked, and 7 districts that we think should be landmarked. Councilman Youssef Salam thinks that LPC should just designate them all in one fell swoop. And they could do that. I don't think they will. And the chairman just retired yesterday. She won't be replaced until January with the new mayor. Because, you know, they're not going to name somebody now. When there's going to be an election in November. So that's just going to slow everything down even more. So it's very, very frustrating. And I think the physical preservation is the hardest, but the most important. I think the softer items, the music, the literature, the art, I think that all of that is probably is easier. Because it's not financially threatening. You know, like, but the architecture is.
Earlier you said, like, well, I know why less of it is designated. Were you referring to kind of the financial threat that it poses?
No, I was referring to the fact that you know, this is a black community. And so, you know, we don't get the same priorities. That's just the way it is. And now, it's getting, I mean, with the orange agent in charge, it's gonna get even worse. He wants to close the African American Museum in Washington. You know, somebody said to me yesterday at the wedding, they said to me that Trump has fired all the government workers who are 90% African American so that he can make them all slaves again. Mm. It's like, okay, I don't think it's that bad. But
it tells a story.
But, you know, I mean, it's really, it's very, very concerning what's going on in the country at large, and Harlem in particular. So I think now with Sarah Carroll being retired, it's just going to slow us down even more for getting things designated. And, you know, the developers are coming in, you know, they really want this land, they want this property, they want to build high-rise buildings. And if the property is not landmarked, it's endangered. So,
what are some other ways that you're continuing to kind of make moves as State Harlem now, despite all of these challenges and slowdowns?
Well, we're getting ready to embark on a community involvement. You know, trying to get the residents in the buildings that we want landmarked and the districts that we want landmarked, designated, to come together and be like a one voice. Instead of having, like Claudette likes to say, a top-down approach with the board and officers of Save Harlem Now leading the charge, to have a bottom-up approach to get the community organized to lead the charge. So that's our challenge now, you know, to get that organized. And so we were just talking about that yesterday in our board meeting and how we're going to go forward with that. And one of the things we're going to do is highlight the properties and districts that we want to get designated through social media, like a blitz. Take one at a time, you know, do a social media blitz, go into the community, knock on doors, you know, really try to do the community organizing to go along with the efforts that the Save Harlem Now Board is doing. So that's our next challenge.
We've talked a bit about like your retirement, like the work in your retirement and your childhood, but I'm curious about also like your college years, your career.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I went to Antioch College in Ohio. My father really wanted me to go to Spelman, but I was a 60s radical, and I just couldn't do that restriction, that all-girls school with the white gloves. And, you know, Spelman was very prim and proper at that time. Mm. I vindicated myself because my daughter went to Spelman, and now my granddaughter is going to Spelman.
Okay.
No thanks, I'm good. So my father would be happy, even though, well, he did see his granddaughter graduate from Spelman, my daughter, but he won't see his great-great-granddaughter graduate from Spelman. Anyway, so I went to Antioch. I majored in education. I came out, I actually moved to Washington, D.C. immediately because a lot of my friends were in D.C. And I taught school in Washington, D.C. and realized that even though I liked the kids, I did not like the department bureaucracy, you know. I just couldn't deal with that. So I was like, okay, this is not for me. So then I started working for a nonprofit in Washington, that was dealing with the housing crisis at that time in the Shaw community of Washington, which is now all gentrified with millionaires. And then after that, a lot of my friends started moving back to New York, and I had a friend from college who was working in the HR department at CVS, and she told me, she said, you know, I think you'll like this. So she got me a job at CVS, and I had a 40-year career in the broadcast advertising industry after that. I worked at CVS, I worked at a CBS television station, I worked at Arbitron Ratings, which does not exist anymore, but was a full-on competitor to Nielsen. You know, we did the same job, just differently. So starting at Arbitron, I was a salesperson and sales manager. And then Arbitron shut down its TV division. I went to work for my husband, who's a dentist, in his office as his office manager for about 18 months. And actually, he's downstairs now,
yeah.
But at that time he was in the Bronx, at an office in the Bronx,
okay.
Right across the 149th Street Bridge. But we were better as a married couple than as people working together. So I left.
Chose marriage.
Right. And went back into the broadcast advertising industry. And I worked for a company that was a software vendor that all of our programs facilitated the buying and selling of time. So advertising agencies used it to buy advertising time, broadcasters used it to sell advertising time. I always worked with the broadcasters on the sell side. So I was a salesman there, and that's the company I retired from. I had a wonderful career. The broadcast advertising business is very dynamic, and I would say almost every year there was something major new to learn, you know, that you had to know to get your job done. And to me, that was that was very exciting. And the people in that industry, some of them can be a little rough around the edges, especially the salespeople, the time salespeople. But everybody's trying to make money, and it's just a good vibe. I really enjoyed my work. I really did.
Do you feel some of what you enjoyed about that work coming into what you're doing now?
I do, because again, for me, even though I've been in Harlem all my life, Harlem wasn't my life, like it is Valerie's. So I learn a lot, even though I've been here forever. There's a lot I don't know about Harlem, because it wasn't the center of my attention. It was just the place that I lived. So I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot about the people, the leadership here, the issues, the processes, you know, for getting things done. I learned a lot from Valerie. She's unbelievable. And I'm very glad that I decided to work with her. She's a little frustrating because she has her hands in so many things. And, you know, we always wish that she would just concentrate on us. But you know, we understand, you know, that she, because of her connections to other things, that helps help Saehwan now get noticed, because everybody knows who she is, you know, so we forgive her. she's fabulous. She's great. So yeah, I do have that same dynamic that I had when I was working, of learning new things. I do.
When you were working at CBS and, you know, continuing in that industry, were you also involved in kind of any organizations or?
I was very involved with my church, Canaan Baptist Church. Yeah.
What sorts of things did you do at Canaan?
Mostly literary type stuff. That I started out as the editor of the church newsletter, which came out every other month. And I did that for many years. And then I was also in two choirs. Rehearsed with the choirs and sang on our designated Sundays. And then after the newsletter, I turned the newsletter over to somebody else. And then the pastor asked me to be over all of the church's publications. So we did everything. We did the Sunday bulletin every week. There were always like special programs that ministries in the church would put on. We did all their programs. We did the newsletter. You know, any kind of written communication we did. That took up a lot of my time. My outside activity was my church. And then in 2006, I had my first grandchild. So my granddaughters, when they were little, they took up a lot of my time. I spent a lot of time with them. They just live in Mount Vernon.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
And how many children?
I only have one.
You have one?
Yeah. Okay.
Has your child like been in Harlem with?
She lived in Harlem with us.
Yeah.
Until she went to med school, and she went to Spelman. So she left home to go to Spelman, and then she sat out a year. She actually worked for my husband for a year. They got along much better than we did. And then she went to med school. So I guess she lived here all that time. We moved here. Actually, the reason that we moved here was because we were living in Brooklyn. And she got accepted into the Macy Medical Program at A. Philip Randolph High School in the ninth grade. And her commute from where we lived to A. Philip Randolph High School was like almost 2 hours each way. So my husband and I said, okay, we gotta move. So we said we would move to Harlem. And it turned out that my accountant at the time owned this house. And he was trying to sell it. We were looking at apartments and we couldn't find anything. The apartments were just horrible. And they wanted all this rent for them. So my accountant said, why don't you buy a house? And I was like, I can't afford to buy a house. And he said, I'll make it affordable for you. You can buy my house. Because he wanted to get rid of this house. So I was like, okay. So I came and looked at it. I said, okay, this house is fine, you know. So we bought the house in 1986, and she started at A. Philip Randolph. So she lived here all during her high school years, and then she went to college, and then she came back and stayed for a little while. She went to med school. 2 years after med school, she got married. And they actually moved here for a year while my son-in-law was looking for a house. He did not want an apartment. He has his own construction business.
Okay.
So they bought this fixer-upper in Mount Vernon that he totally redid. So they've been married. They got married in 2003.
Okay.
So they have a 19-year-old and a 16-year-old. So the 19-year-old is starting her sophomore year at Spelman next week. And the 16-year-old goes to Cardinal Spelman High School. She's a junior. Yeah. So I love my granddaughters. I tell people I created Monsters because they both love Broadway.
Okay.
But that's because I've been taking them there since they were like six. Okay. To see different shows.
Was that part of your childhood?
No.
No. Yeah.
and I actually didn't even do that much of it with my daughter. You do so many things, so many more things with your grandchildren than you do with your children. Yeah. You know, because with Robin, I had to work and I had to take care of the house, and you know, now I'm retired, I can do whatever I want. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You want to hang out with your grandkids,
right?
And stay home.
Right. Exactly. So yeah. So that's my life now.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that we talked a little bit about, some of the challenges? Actually, I want to ask more about the house.
This house?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Okay.
What do you know about the history of this house?
Okay, this house was, I don't know much about, I know a little about the history. It was built in 1901. When we moved in here, you could see that it had been divided up like into rooms, because like all the doors had locks on them.
Okay.
And actually my neighbor, two houses up, he was here when we moved in, and he told me that he used to live in this house in one of the rooms back in the 70s. My accountant, I don't know if he had to put people out or what when he bought the house, but when he bought it, he made it like a one family thing. So when we first moved in here, we lived downstairs where my husband's office is now. Mm-hmm. It was like two bedrooms, one for us, one for Robin. Mm-hmm. And we had this floor. And then we rented the top two floors. The very top floor is a one bedroom apartment. And then floor above this one was just two bedrooms, like they were rooms that we put a microwave and a small refrigerator. So we had that for a long time. Then we got rid of the tenants on the middle floor because Abel brought his office here. So we had to move from downstairs to upstairs. The top floor is still a rented one bedroom apartment. We've had two major tenants. The first tenant was Herman Farrell. His name was Herman Farrell, young guy. I never put it two all together. And then when the day that he moved in, he came with his father. And his father was Denny Farrell.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, you're that Herman Farrell. Okay. So Herman was here for 10 years, and then he got married and moved to Kentucky. His wife was a drama professor, and Herman himself turned into a playwright. He wrote one, I know he wrote at least one play because we went to see it. I don't know how many he's written after that. So Herman left after 10 years. Then we had a woman who was here. She was only here for a little while. And then now we have Stephanie, who has been here since 2015. Does it go off again?
check here. Okay, yeah, this is fine.
Okay. Stephanie's been here since 2015. She's a nurse practitioner. She's a wonderful tenant. She's very quiet. She pays her rent on time. Mm-hmm. Can't ask for any more than that. As far as the history of the house, all I know is that it used to be a rooming house, mm-hmm. and that my neighbor up the street used to live in here, yeah. and that it was built in 1901. The other thing about this house, it is one of the, I think it's the smallest brownstone that they made, I think. And so my house is only 14 feet wide. But most brownstones are like 18, 20, 25 feet wide. Mm-hmm. So this is a small house by comparison. But, you know, it's fine for us. Yeah. And actually, my husband always said, people ask him, because we've been married 41 years, and people ask him, what does it take to stay married for so long? And he always tells them, a really big house.
Yeah.
Right, so.
And you're, you know, it's narrow.
It's narrow, but, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. Can I ask you about what you're sitting on?
This is from Israel, actually. And a friend of mine had a friend who was moving. She lived on the Lower East Side. And for some reason, I was with him one day and he was like, I have to go by and see her. And he said, you can come with me, you know, just be a few minutes. I was like, okay. So we went to her house, and she had this bench. And I was like, oh my God, that is so beautiful. And she's like, do you want it? Mm-hmm. She says, I'm moving, I'm not taking it with me. She gave it to me.
Wow.
Okay. It's nice though, isn't it?
It is. I thought it came from one of the churches.
No. Okay. It came from, and she told me that it was Israeli.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've had it, oh my goodness, I've had this since before we moved here, because I had it in my apartment in Brooklyn. So, 40 years, I guess, I've had this.
Wow.
Yeah. I like benches.
Yeah.
I have another one in my living room that was in my mother's house that I had brought here. Yeah. So.
Maybe to zoom out. Thinking about kind of Harlem more broadly and your life experience here, and then what historical events do you think have most shaped your experience in this neighborhood? It's a big question.
That's interesting. I think definitely the March on Washington and going through that as far as a historical event is concerned. Also, I was here, but I was a kid when Martin Luther King got shot in Bloomsdale's. And that was very scary. I remember being really scared that he was going to die.
Yeah.
So that's another one.
Were you around your church family at the time?
Yeah.
What was
and my dad, because my dad was good friends with him.
Yeah.
So he was very upset. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of scary to me because I had never seen my father get upset like that. But fortunately, he was okay. Yeah. He wasn't shot. He was stabbed. Mm-hmm. Right. Not shot.
So I learned recently that the responding officer is the same person who eventually got Showman's.
Really?
Yeah. And he passed away in 2021, 2022.
Oh, okay.
So that was an interesting crossover.
Oh, wow. Okay. What else? I hate to belabor death, but I also remember the assassination of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. I wasn't here then, but I remember being, you know, like knowing exactly where he was, and you know, being really upset about that too. Mm-hmm. That's all I can think of right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a broad question.
Okay. Yeah.
And then, let's see. And then I'm also just maybe as a kind of, there's one last question I'll ask you after this, but another kind of broad question is like, how does Harlem shape, I know that you're working in Harlem, you're working to like preserve parts of Harlem, but how does your experience in Harlem really shape how you think about your work today?
How I think about my work?
Yeah.
It shapes it a lot, because, you know, this is the place that I remember, you know, of my childhood. Even though I'm not familiar with a lot of events that have happened, you know, like Valerie is, I know all the places. You know, I can take you anywhere and all. So, you know, just the familiarity of the landscape, you know, makes me very comfortable in what I'm doing, and, you know, really kind of open to learning more about, you know, what has happened in all these spaces that I know so well. My history, I don't think I would be doing this job if I hadn't grown up in Harlem. You know, I don't think I would be interested, you know?
Do you feel like it's a challenge to get people who did not grow up here interested in the work?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Is that something you're trying to or interested in doing?
Well, yes and no. I was thinking specifically about people to giving us money.
Yeah.
You know, which we're always looking for. And most of the time, we have to appeal to resources that are not familiar with Harlem. You know, corporations and grant funding sources. I mean, there are some that are familiar with Harlem that we have gotten money from, but most of them, you know, where the opportunity lies, are not. So yes, I am interested in getting them more familiar with Harlem so that they will give us money. And you know, that's a challenge. Yeah.
So you're the treasurer of State Harlem now.
Yes.
And it sounds like your job also includes, or your position also includes, like development activities and pulling in funders. Can you tell
yes.
me more about like kind of the nuts and bolts of what you do?
Well, this past year, I have written 3 grant applications, all of which were denied. Right now, there's something called the Foundation Directory that has pretty much all the foundations in the U.S. in it. And so I'm going to be working with our administrative assistant, who has started doing some research and an application deadline calendar for foundations that might fund us. I'm particularly looking for capacity money, because we really need to hire some more staff. And right now we don't have the money to do that. I would like to hire, we can't afford a full-fledged development director, but this is something that I have never done before. And, you know, in writing the application, I know that there is a way to do that, that, you know, makes you more successful than other ways. And I'm thinking if we could hire like a development consultant who could, you know, help us identify sources that are more likely to give us money based on their experience. And then also tell us how to ask for it, you know. So that's my treasurer's priority right now. We really need money. We need money. We need money. We need money. The gala, you know, gave us a little breathing room. We raised a lot more money this year than we did last year.
Why do you think that is?
I think it was better organized, and we started earlier. 2024, I don't think we started until March. Oh, no, not March. Till maybe February. I'm sorry, 2023 for 24.
Okay.
But 2024 for 25, we started in October 2024. Okay. And now for 2026, we've already started.
All right.
Yeah. So, you know, it was just the first time out. You know, we learned a lot. We made a lot of mistakes. We learned from them. And so we made a lot more money this year than we made last year. But we still didn't make enough. So, I'm looking to, you know, get some grant money, you know, for capacity building. And hopefully.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were fortunate, you know, in 2022, the National Trust, the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund at the National Trust. We applied for money to hire an executive director, $140,000, and we actually got that.
Right, nice.
But that paid our executive director for 2 years, and now we're on our own. And for the African American Fund, you can apply again, but not in the same category. So the category that we applied for was capacity building. But we can't go back to, you know, they have five different areas that they funded. But we can't go back to the capacity one because we've already gotten money from there. So we need to find somebody else who'll give us money for capacity building.
And this might seem like a very basic question, but I'm curious, like, as the treasurer and having kind of experience in different institutions, what is it that money makes possible? Like, why is it such a central part of
this? Money makes everything possible. But, you know, specifically for us, like I said, if we could hire a development consultant, somebody to tell us how to apply and who to apply to, based on their experience. You know, I mean, money makes everything possible. We can hire more staff. If we hire more staff, we could have more programs. You know, we could do more outreach if we had more staff. You know, I mean, money is everything. And, you know, without it, you can't do a whole lot without money. So it is critically important that we, you know, raise more money.
When you first got involved with Safe Harlem Now, was it specifically to be the treasurer?
Valerie asked me to be the treasurer. When I came on, she said the organization needs a treasurer.
Do you have a sense of why you were asked to do the treasurer role?
I think Valerie has a lot of trust in me. I'm treasurer of other organizations, or have been. Like, I'm treasurer of my family. Oh God, I forgot to do that today. Okay. I am treasurer. Yeah, my family reunion is very organized. We plan. It's every other year. We're planning. We had it last year. We're planning now for next year. And family members have to pay dues, and we have to pay vendors for the reunion. We have a picnic. We have a dinner dance, a catered dinner dance, and a catered picnic that, you know, the family members have to pay for. And then we have to pay the vendors. We buy t-shirts. You know, I mean, there's a lot of money going back and forth. So I have been the family treasurer for 25 years. I have tried to give this job away. Many times.
Yeah.
And they're like, you got it. That's another gift I think I got from my dad. He was a master with money. I wish he was around now to tell me how to raise this money, because he was a master fundraiser. He and the college president of Morehouse at the time, in the 80s, they raised the money to build Morehouse Medical School. And the college thanked my dad they had a brand new campus center built, and they named it after him. So there's this huge building on Morehouse campus that's named after my father. But he really knew how to raise money. He did it for SCLC. So I wish I had paid more attention to that. I didn't know I would need that skill.
What are some of the things you do remember about, like, how he made that happen? Or?
I don't know how he made it happen. I just remember sometimes I heard him do vocal appeals, you know, to various audiences.
Like at the service?
At the service, at conventions, at SCLC meetings. You know, I did hear him do that. But I'm sure, you know, for the medical school money, you gotta do more than that. You know, so I'm sure he was also, that's probably how he did it. He was also chairman of the Morehouse Board of Trustees for 25 years. And the trustees of Morehouse, some of them were like titans of industry. One of them was the chairman of, I remember the office is on 7th Avenue. The Morehouse Board met twice a year, once in New York, once in Atlanta. And there was a big insurance company that had offices on 7th Avenue in the 50s. And when they met in New York, they would meet there. But that guy, the CEO of that insurance company, which the name of it I'm not going to remember, was on the Morehouse Board. Spike Lee was on the Morehouse Board. So I'm sure he leveraged a lot of those contacts that he met as the Morehouse Board Chair, you know, to raise money. Yeah. So, yeah. He was really good at it. He was really good at it.
Curious if there are like things that you anticipated talking about today, or that you like are remembering as we're talking, that you really want to share that I maybe didn't ask about.
No, I think you were, I really didn't know what to expect. So actually, I mean, I'm really kind of pleasantly surprised that it was so easy. No, I mean, this is great. I had fun.